What's up?
Welcome to the Entangled Podcast. My name is Ashley.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Henry. We are three educators from Teach for America that get together on this podcast to talk about education in Louisiana and all the subjects entangled within it. See what I did there?
In each episode, we unpack the latest news of Louisiana state of education, discuss the hottest topics in the field, and make sense of it all with a touch of humor.
Thank you for tuning into this episode, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Entangled. Super excited for our episode today. How y'all feeling?
I am feeling great. I think I know what day it is. It is Thursday.
Yes, I also feel great. This is the Thursday before the Thanksgiving break. So it is a good Thursday.
Amen.
Yes, amen. So we are recording this on a Thursday. You will be hearing this on a Thursday. But yes, super excited. Hope that y'all have a wonderful break. We're recording this before the break. Have a great break, y'all. And we're going to jump right into current events.
Events. There's a lot of things happening over the past couple of weeks. So first, we'll start with State Superintendent of Education, Dr. Kay Brumley, named Rapides Parish Schools Pre-Educator Pathway as one of Louisiana's Models of Excellence, a statewide award that recognizes benchmark programs that exemplify excellence in the state of Louisiana, hence the name. So their pre-educator pathway immerses students into meaningful fields and clinical experiences, allowing them to begin learning how to become high quality educators. Look how cute this is. They are training up kids in high school to get ready to come into the teaching profession, which, as we have talked about, we already know the deal per the great resignation episode that we on a struggle bus right now. And so I really appreciate this is like a pre-educator pathway. But this is really cool. And I'm excited to learn a little bit more about that program.
Yeah, they might be the ones to save us.
Shout out to Rapides Parish. We're looking out. And speaking of the teacher shortage, on the other end of the spectrum, Tangipahoa schools will go virtual on Friday because of employee leave requests and because of there being a lack of subs. So they are going to go virtual and start virtual instruction back up because their board and administration is trying to figure out how to have bodies in the classroom. Students are expected to return to classes the Monday after Thanksgiving. So I'm assuming this already happened per our recording schedule. But it sounds like they had a week virtual just due to the number of people who were going to be starting their break early, possibly, maybe not.
that's really interesting. So does that mean that they feel pretty confident that they'll have all the staff that they need by the time they come back from break?
I guess so.
Yeah, this is happening. So I know for sure it's happened in Michigan. My mom is a teacher in Michigan. And yeah, my mom's school did the same thing. And so they're hoping to return after the holiday break. But like, this is happening. This is a real thing. Like, it's not good. And I mean, they were able to find some folks to fill the positions. But, you know, when you think about it, teachers leave schools and go to other schools. So now it means that school doesn't have a teacher. So it's like, it's just going to be a transition of, you know, of different things. So just shout out to educators and please enjoy this break because I know y'all need it.
Well-deserved break. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Transitioning back to COVID because still here. East Baton Rouge Parish schools are going to lift their mask mandate in schools in January if COVID is still low. I don't know what low means and how they've chosen to define it, but As you know, the governor has already lifted the statewide mask mandate on October 26th, but some other parishes and school systems decided to continue with it because it's, you know, sometimes a necessity, I guess. So Superintendent Sito Narcisse said he decided to lift the mask mandate based on the advice of medical professionals who sit on the district's health advisory committee. It doesn't go into detail of like what the numbers are. I'm sure we could check the tracker. So mask wearing will shift from required to optional on January 4th when students and staff return from the holiday break, unless cases increase and produce a positivity rate of 0.5% or greater over a 10 to 14 day period. So it sounds like they're going to be making changes and adjustments on a needed basis, maybe. But I have a feeling individual schools are going to be like, wear your mask. Thanks.
Oh, okay. I mean, until when?
I mean, that's just my opinion. I have a feeling that some of the schools, I mean, you can't enforce it, but I feel like some schools are just going to be like, we would actually really appreciate that you keep your mask on.
Right, right. Or you can keep it a school policy, I guess.
Yeah. And then until somebody starts to complain, and then you can be like, well, it's optional. Well, it's optional. So we'll see. But along with lifting their that mask mandate, LSU also lifted their mask mandate earlier this week, so Tuesday, because they said they have won the fight against the spread of coronavirus. So they obviously also talked to a health advisory to figure out if this was the right decision to make.
Yeah.
And so masks are now not required on LSU's campus.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I've always found this mask wearing dynamic interesting because I just think because of the nature of kids, there's going to be inconsistencies, right? Like some who are wearing it on their chins and some who are wearing it just above their upper lip, and then just others who are like wearing it properly, but then they take it off for some other reasons, and then and I'm like, okay, yeah. I'd love the consistency. That's what I would love.
Yeah. I just know I can only be consistent for myself. So Miss Anderson will be wearing a mask upon entering a school building.
Yep.
Same here. And navigating. So that is all I got today from the newsroom.
Bam. Okay, so I'm very excited to introduce our guests for this episode. With us today, we have the wonderful Emma Merrill and Sharuba Chavez, who are both advocates for English language learners, who are educators at heart, and who have a consulting company called Consulted NOLA. We're going to talk to them about how to best help our ELL students as educators and beyond. So without further ado, Emma, Sharuba, welcome to today's episode. How are y'all?
Good, doing well. Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
Absolutely. Ashley, Taylor, how y'all feeling?
Still here.
And you know, I'm doing what it do when it do when it does. Okay.
That's the vibe. That's the feeling right there, right? That's the feeling. All right. Well, why don't we start off by having y'all introduce yourselves? I'm just going to go in alphabetical order here. So Ms. Chavez, if you wouldn't mind starting us off, tell us about yourself, like, you know, who you are, anything you want to share, plus like what got you into this kind of work?
Yeah. Well, like you said, I'm the founder of Consulted NOLA, where we do a lot of EL work and training for general education teachers in the city. But that's on top of our day jobs. During the day, I'm an educational diagnostician at NOLA Public Schools at the district. But my 24/7 job is I'm a mama of two beautiful babies. So that's what I do full time. But as far as education, yeah, so I've taught special education. I've taught English as a second language. And I think those experiences, right, have brought me and Emma together in the work that we're doing today.
Hi, I'm Emma Merrill. I am currently the director of Las Sierras Academy, We're in our founding year, and it is for scholars who are newcomers to the country in high school. And so, you know, we have about 47 kids right now. We're within Carver High School in the ninth ward, and just keep expanding and keep getting more kids every day, which is very exciting. But prior to that, I was the EL director and still am at Collegiate Academies, the network of charter schools. And I used to be the ESL teacher at Carver and was there for 7 years doing that before, you know, the dream to start a newcomer school became a reality. And Truva and I joined forces. We've known each other through this work for a long time, but we joined forces like officially as part of Consult Ed NOLA, and then with the Excel graduation pathway, which we'll talk about later, about a year and a half ago. You know, she's my work wife in a lot of ways.
Speaking of wives, I understand that you became a wife pretty recently, so congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I still, you know, technically called him fiance, but that's not true. Husband.
Mm-hmm. Close enough. Yeah. They're related.
Well, congratulations. I'm so happy to have you all on, and I'm really happy to learn more about the work that you do, but more than anything, to really share a lot of your findings, wisdoms, and experiences with our audience. So why don't we start off by talking about the students that you are working with? Like, so who are the students that you're seeing? Like, what are the demographics of the students that you're working with, and what are their general stories?
In New Orleans, our population of English learners, and specifically families that are Latinx, has grown exponentially. I don't know if you've seen the new census data, but something like 30% within the past 10 years. It's the fastest growing minority population in the city right now. And what that means is there are kids coming to us at all ages who are new to the country, who are needing to learn English, and needing a lot of supports in the classroom in order to do so. We saw in 2014 our first big influx of this population. That's when I first started teaching at Carver. And since then, schools have figured out, okay, I need to do this, 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 and this to support these kids and have an ESL program and have ESL teachers. And things have evolved so that, you know, now as a city, we have our first newcomer program. But I think to put faces to the numbers are, I specifically work with kids who are in high school. And so I have 47 kids who this is their first 3 months to 4 months in the country. And they are between the ages of 14 and 18. I have a senior, Stephanie, she's 19, and she hopes to graduate in May, which is very exciting, right? But when you think about Stephanie is brand new to the country and has to pass final exams in order to graduate, but she's 19 and she has to learn English in a year in order to pass those final exams to graduate. It's a huge, huge task. And it's something that is a gift and a curse, right? To be able to say, I'm learning how to speak a second language. I'm bilingual. But I need a lot of supports that some schools are able to provide right now and some schools are really struggling with. And also up against a lot of barriers, right? Especially when it comes to requirements to graduate, things like that. But I also want to just specify that our English learner population is growing as a whole. So it's not just kids who are Latino, right? I have one kid who is from Haiti and speaks French, and none of his teachers speak French, but we're all using the same skills to be able to help Polly understand everything. So, Chiruba.
I mean, yeah, just speaking to the urgency of this work and making sure that our schools are ready for these kids that are coming here every day, right? And making sure that not only policy is in place to support these children, but also making sure teachers, right, the people that they spend the most face time with, are trained in the skills of universal language, right, the SIOP model, ensuring that we, right, as educators are knowledgeable of the background, the families, the values that they bring, so that we can be respectful to them and their families, because they are trusting us, right? They come here with purpose, they come here with dreams and with passion, and they're trusting us as a safe place, right? School is one of the safest places that our newcomers feel. It's not a place where they have to look over their shoulder. It's not a place where they have to hide who they are. And so it's on us as educators to make sure that it's a welcoming environment for them.
Ooh, I cannot wait to dive in. Oh, I cannot wait. So here's, okay, I'll tell you why this subject, at least for me, is like so close and dear to my heart. I am also an immigrant. I migrated to the United States when I was 9. So, I mean, it's a difference too, right? Like having to teach someone who is 9 years old a new language and then kind of move them through the school system versus someone who's 16, 17, 18, 19 and trying to do the same thing. So I'm very intrigued. And so I'm wondering why for you all, what is it that connects you to this work or you know, what got you interested in working particularly with newcomers, with English language learners, given that, I mean, I don't know what your backgrounds are as far as like immigration status, but like what got you interested in working with this population?
So in college, I belong to this organization called Students Helping Honduras. I love to travel and I wanted to join this organization because I wanted to go to Honduras and I spoke Spanish and I loved Spanish. And so we went to Honduras during our winter breaks and the goal was to build 1,000 schools in this community, El Progreso. And so I was helping build schools every winter break. And then the director of the organization said to me, sent me a message and was like, Emma, I think you'd be a really great teacher. I want you to come down during a summer and teach. And I was like, oh shit, never thought about that. I'm studying government right now. And so of course I said yes, because you're going to say yes when somebody asks you that, you know, and stayed for a summer, taught kindergarten through third grade English, made my own curriculum, roughing it, lived, you know, in a house with no electricity, with bucket showers alongside the kids, and absolutely fell in love with them. And fell in love with the idea that language is so powerful and to be able to grow with your kids through language, as well as have them grow as humans, became an inspiration for me. So immediately applied for Teach for America right after that, joined Teach for America, moved to Denver. And then of course, because I speak Spanish, got placed in a school for Mexican immigrants. And then I found out about this job here and was asked to come down to interview and realized that 90% of the population that I'd be serving were Honduran. So tied right back to my roots and why I got into this work to begin with and never looked back.
That's beautiful. Ms. Chavez, what about you?
And my story is not as moving. It was more of an accident for me, I guess. So I was already teaching special education at a K-8 and happened to be an opening for EL the following year. And I happened to be the only Spanish speaker in the village. So it just, you know, was a natural fit. But quickly when I made the transition, I realized so many of the protections for our children with exceptionalities and so many of the processes, things in place to make sure those children had access to an equitable education was not there for our English learners. And I was working at a K-8 space at a time, made the transition to high school, was back in special education. But when I saw the unique struggles of, you know, like you talked about, our newcomers in high school versus our newcomers when they're younger, I felt a lot of guilt. I was, you know, learning about the requirements that they would have to pass the leap and things to graduate, I was like, I would have done things a lot differently. K-8, you know, had I known what I was preparing them for. So a lot of this, a lot of the work now, I feel like it's out of penance, right? A lot of guilt that I'm like trying to make sure that the children that are coming now have the best educators in front of them and have the best pathway forward and can see a pathway forward up until they graduate. So currently, you know, as an educational diagnostician, doing the pupil appraisal gives you like a more zoomed out perspective. So I've really enjoyed that and also exploring a lot of the intersection between EL and SPED as well, which is pretty unique.
Ooh, yeah. And I'm sure we find a lot of that in New Orleans, right? I can't wait to talk about that too. What about for Taylor, Ashley, like, did y'all have like a big population of English learners when you were teaching?
I had one student my third year. His home language is Spanish. And so that was, I taught kindergarten. So that was very difficult because I was never able to communicate with his parents because I am not fluent in Spanish. And then he was cutting up a little bit in the first couple of months of school because he was like, I don't know what's going on here, girl, but I ain't with it. So he was like hitting other kids. And I'm like, friend, you can't put your hands on other kids. So I'm like, how do I need to say that in Spanish. Shout out to Google Translate for getting us through. Not a promising practice. And it is what I had to use at that moment. But I wouldn't say there was a huge population. There were students that came to our school who did need some extra services so we can communicate with them effectively. But it wasn't like in mass.
Yeah. And what years were those when you were in the classroom?
That was in 2018.
So I'm sure like the population has grown exponentially since, right?
Yeah.
What about you, Ms. Jordan?
Yeah, pretty similar. So I taught middle school for context, and I also taught in Baton Rouge. Taylor and I both taught in Baton Rouge. And so, which is also interesting moving to the New Orleans area because it is vastly different. But like as a middle school teacher in the Baton Rouge area, I didn't really teach as many students who spoke a second language. Now, I will say I taught in Donaldsonville for just a little bit in Ascension Parish, and I did have a few students. But by middle school at that point, my students were able to kind of like navigate, you know, ask questions, work with one another, partner up to ensure that, you know, their classmate or whoever was in class also got the support that they needed. So seeing that relationship and that, you know, even just in general, like students' abilities to be able to like figure out what they need for themselves and like get what they need was also interesting. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing, y'all. Yeah. I also, surprisingly, I didn't have like a class of ELL students, though I told the school I was open to it, though I also am a Spanish speaker. I also let them know that I am an immigrant. Though I did have some students, right, who were also immigrants or who also had a limited proficiency in English, I fortunately like had the experience of like the student of being a student in those, you know, in those positions, but I didn't necessarily know the best practices. And so like you, Sharuba, I too was like, man, I really wish I could have done things differently. I wish I would have known more to be able to set those students up for success when they take their exams, when they're taking, you know, the state exams that they have to pass in order to get their high school diplomas. So speaking of these best practices, y'all are the ones that I would turn to for that, right? Like if I had known you when I was a teacher, I'd be like, oh man, Emma, can we link up? Or Sharuba, can we link up? I there's a lot I don't know. And so let's say for your average educator who has students who are, you know, limited in English proficiency, like what would you say are some of the best practices for them to be able to best serve those students?
I think there are so many, but Truba's going to say we need to start with PSYOP. Truba, you want to start the PSYOP introduction and I'll add in.
I mean, PSYOP is the only way that is research-based that is proven to make gains for children who are learning English. And it's also the most realistic, right? Because kids are with content teachers most of the day. Most schools aren't staffed enough to have kids in pull-out classes, right? Learning the English language. And we want our kids to be exposed to content. So the PSYOP model, which stands for Sheltered Instruction Observation Protocol, is a method that has 8 components. And it shows how content instruction and language instruction can be married and can exist in a K-12 space across content, across settings, across kids of different proficiencies, of different backgrounds in a general education classroom.
Yeah, and my one thing to add to that is even I use PSYOP, even though I'm not in a shelter classroom, in a content room that has, you know, native speakers of English, I use PSYOP because it helps me to be able to do all the strategies, right? I can add visuals, I can add gestures, I can make sure that my content is comprehensible and I'm like connecting it to kids' home experiences, and I'm connecting it to what they've seen in their home countries. SciUp is just good teaching, but with a lot of like really good strategies. My goal as a teacher of newcomers is actually to speak and have 90% plus of my lesson in English. And that comes from the American Council of Teaching Foreign Language. And 90% of my lesson is in English, but I make it comprehensible so kids understand. I taught today about, you know, the evidence of evolution. And we're talking about, I don't know if y'all know, vestigial structures, homologous structures, analogous structures.
Oh, yeah.
Fossil records. So we're learning about all these things, right? And I'm never using Spanish. I have if they have to read like a longer text, I might give them the Spanish version side by side, but we're labeling, we're explaining in two languages. They're explaining on their paper in both English and Spanish. And we're like talking together through the talking this out as the class while I'm giving them the language to use to support their own learning. And yeah, and that's all SciUp in our 6-part series that we train teachers on that we're the best at in the city. So
love it. Yeah. Shameless.
And I want to stamp, so y'all don't want me teaching biology in English or Spanish, but I know a lot of people like default to translation, but yeah. For a lot of our kids, so a lot of our kids who have just come here, the profile has changed quite a bit. So a lot of our older newcomers that are in high school haven't been in a formal education setting in years, right? A lot of them, their last completed grade was 5th grade in their country, right? And then they come to us at 14, 15, 16, and we call these kids SIFE, students with interrupted formal education. So sometimes translating directly to the home language doesn't make sense, because they don't have their equivalent academic vocabulary in their home language. So in our series, Emma and I talk a lot about the difference between BICS, the social language, and CALP, the academic language, and why the SciUp method is very important in making messages universal, regardless of literacy in first language.
That's really cool. Very reassuring too, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying that I don't necessarily have to speak the language of the students who I'm teaching in order to teach them, right? Like I don't have to speak their native language in order to teach them? Or would you say like there still should be some?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like just, you know, from intake, right? And just like enrollment and stuff, like there definitely needs to be bilingual staff and people who provide, you know, related services, counseling, social work, like those are all needed, right? Especially in native language. But I know schools in Jefferson Parish, majority minority schools, you have 7, 8, 9 languages represented in one classroom. So Emma's right, like target language should be, you know, English should be 90% of what we do in making those messages universal. But at the end of the day, everyone's an ESL teacher. Everyone teaches kids who are English learners.
Yeah. And I just want to add that honestly, sometimes it's easier to be an ESL teacher when you don't speak the language, right? Because I and so many teachers in my program, I'm saying, y'all, we're speaking way too much in Spanish. We're using way too much Spanish. Kids are not going to grow fast enough if we don't meet that 90% goal in our classrooms. So I, 2 years ago, had a wonderful ESL teacher. Her name was Amanda Antilli. And she did not speak any Spanish, and her kids met their end of year growth goals because she's using all of these tools that we worked on every single day. And, you know, sometimes, and this is another part of SciUp too, but sometimes on the wall, you'll have key terms in both languages so you can refer back to in case kids are ever confused and you're like, oh yeah, what is environment? What is that in Spanish? Okay, now put that in the sentence, right? But it can actually be a crutch to speak the same language of the kids in your room sometimes if you're relying on that way too much.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I can even relate to that because as a student, I remember, though I had Spanish-speaking friends, I don't think any of my teachers spoke any Spanish. And so instruction-wise, like it took time, but eventually I just started catching on. It's just like it's just amazing. The young mind, right? The young mind is just able to absorb like and pick things up so quickly that like, I basically what I'm saying is like, I can also attest to that idea that having a predominantly English instruction is surprisingly effective for our language learners.
Yeah, and I would like to add, like, my Spanish is very, I just made it to unit 2 on Duolingo for my Spanish. But then it was very limited. So I could just use like one word phrases to like let my little friend know, like, hey, you need to stop. I also had another student who was not fully bilingual, but he understood English and Spanish, because Spanish was his home language as well. And at the very beginning, I would be like, hey, can you tell our friend that I said to stop doing that? But in true kindergarten teacher fashion, it is a lot of nonverbals. It is a lot of like pictures. It is a lot of graphs and like slowing down my words so that you are understanding like the pronunciation of things. So you're understanding like what these words actually mean. And then by the end of the year, this child actually surpassed some of my native English speakers in his reading growth because he was just catching on so fast. And some of the other kids were, he passed them up. I'm like, how did this even happen? I'm like, mm-hmm. Wow, how did this happen? So I'm like, shout out to you, friend. He's great. He ended up being like one of my favorites, but don't tell anybody I said that.
Well, I wanna like pinpoint that. I think what you and Henry both just sort of stamped was the kind of this, we call it the silent year. So on average, it takes 6 to 7 years to become proficient in a language, right? And your first year is your receptive year. And so on average, that's why we need these newcomer programs, right? Most kids have a year where they're just taking in information. They're not necessarily producing and speaking as much as you'd like, or they're not necessarily producing as much in writing, but they're taking it in and then they're processing. And because there's so much processing happening in that first year, you'll see major jumps and major growth, right? As long as you're continuing to use the target language. And I think that's another misconception with a lot of teachers in schools too, is like, well, he's not saying anything. He'll never say anything to me. And it's like, well, yeah, he's in his silent period. That's normal. Yeah. That is normal for year one. And so pinpointing that is like the silent period is really important for kids to grow and develop.
Let's say I was an educator that wants to look more into the PSYOP model, or I want to look at additional resources to improve my practices as an educator who teaches English language learners. Do you have any websites or, I don't know, books that you would recommend for people to look into in order to be able to implement these practices easier?
The PSYOP model has released their studies and their strategy workbook every year. So that's an easy like buy. And I absolutely, if you teach kids who speak another language and are English learners, absolutely buy that. There's another book called Strategies for Teaching English Learners, which I got my master's last year and I like studied teaching ESL in college in Virginia too. And we use the same book because I can send you the links, but I think what's important to note is that the study of language acquisition is a new thing, right? It's from the 1970s. So all of the material that has been developed to support this is how you help somebody acquire a language is canon. There are like 3 to 4 textbooks that you should use and you should read and you should dive into. And I can send some of those to you.
Now, I would also encourage educators to consider getting their ESL add-on certification. So in Louisiana, it's just 4 courses, but it's courses dedicated to language acquisition, structure of the English language. I learned a lot from those courses and was able to better attune myself to second language transfer and just some nuances that help us in a real-time setting. But there's a lot of, you know, universities and other post-secondary programs that offer that certification. And it's really valuable training for not just EL teachers, but for general education teachers.
Yeah, that's cool. What about for coaches? Do you feel like Absolutely. Coaches?
And I think Emma could best attest to like you know, coach to coach model, right? Knowing what to look for in your coachees, having in the PSYOP the rubric, right? So we can track different parts of the PSYOP model, different components.
I was like, that would actually be really helpful because I have a couple of core members who have Spanish-speaking students in their class, fifth graders, and they can't engage in the lesson. I'm not exactly sure, like, if this is their first year here or whatever the case may be, but they don't engage with the math lessons or any of the lessons because they're, I guess, for a variety of reasons, I'm sure. And so it would be helpful to, like, for me as a coach of how can I support my core member in supporting her students, as opposed to using the one bilingual student to being the translator, because we know that is also not a promising practice of, like, using that one child to, like, be the go-between between the teacher and the students.
Yeah, I think two things here is one, Truba and my training, most people we've trained are coaches, right? And so our coaches take a lot of that back to their coachees. And the second thing is, if you've heard of Our Voice, Nuestra Voz, in the city, they're starting the DALE Fellowship. They're opening up applications this month, but it's really impactful for a team of three teachers or educators at a school to apply to be part of the fellowship. Their coaching is a little PSYOP light, but it will help any coachees, like, best support English learners socially, emotionally, and be better advocates for those kids in their schools too. I can say this because my husband is the director at Our Voice, Nuestra Voz. DALE is great. It's not PSYOP heavy, but it is a lot about advocacy, and it has a little bit of a PSYOP training as well.
Perfect. Love that. We'll add the link to our show notes as well.
Well, I'm going to shift gears here and talk about the other project that you have with Consulta Nola, which is your policy proposal called Excel that's looking to advocate for better opportunities to really level the playing field for our newcomers. But I would like to really give you the platform to talk more about it and see how how others can support your endeavors.
Truba and I, obviously, we've been working together for a while. The EL community in New Orleans is very small, especially the EL educator community. And we've been working together, talking pre-pandemic. This was, 2019, Truba? I was basically in tears because 24% of my senior class wasn't eligible to graduate because they hadn't passed a LEAP test. And so, if you know, in high school, kids have to pass three LEAP exams in order to graduate, right? So they have to pass an English test, they have to pass a math test, and US history or biology. And I was tasked with that year teaching a US history prep course for nine seniors who are English learners who had not yet passed US history or biology. And by the time December came around, I had one kid pass the test. The last chance was in May. And by May, I had another child pass, which meant I had 24% graduation rate. One of my scholars, Karina, was telling me, you know, I will try and come back next semester to try and graduate again, but I absolutely need a job. Like, I have to provide for my family. So we created a part-time position for her in our school library so that she could take a class, a US history prep course in the morning and work in the library the rest of the day. Danielson said he would come back for one period a day. I had a student, Hang, who felt defeated and was like, I'm done, not doing this anymore. And a couple stories like her. And then Danielson and Karina came back the next semester, and Karina worked really, really hard. She was able to graduate in December. Danielson failed again, said, okay, fine, I'm gonna give this one more shot and then I'm done. And then by that time in February, March, COVID hit, right? So COVID hit, we went virtual, and there was no testing requirements for graduation that year. So 100% of my kids graduated on time for that cohort. And the same thing happened the next year because the testing requirements were waived again. So I went from 24% graduation rate, 2020, 100%, 2021, 100%. And so what that tells us is that, you know, the largest barrier to kids graduating is a state test. And so Truba and I have been working on this for a couple years now, creating a policy that helps our kids who have passed all their classes, who've met seat time requirements and attendance requirements, be able to pass the stage and walk across the stage in May and receive their diplomas.
I mean, these are kids, like Emma said, that are doing everything they have to do to graduate. They've passed all their courses. They've met their seat time requirements. It's just the exam. And so when we stepped back and we did our research, we found that Louisiana is one out of 9 states in the entire country that requires a certain test performance to graduate. Other states, right, you just have to pass your courses, meet your seat time requirements. Some states, you know, you create a portfolio and then you're eligible for graduation. But Louisiana is still, you know, holding that performance metric against kids for graduation. You know, when English learners, when they come here, they are responsible for not learning the content. They're also responsible for learning the language. And they're measured on an assessment called the ELPT in Louisiana that tracks their English proficiency. So this is the only subgroup of students that's actually held accountable for 2 state exams, ELPT and the LEAP exam. And so schools are held accountable to that ELPT growth metric, but 47% of LEAP even making English language proficiency growth because they keep re-enrolling kids in US history, bio, just to pass the test, right? And then kids, yeah, they pass the test, but are they workforce ready, right? Do they have the language to enter the workforce, the community? So what we've proposed, and EXCEL stands for Expanded Criteria for English Learners in Louisiana, is to expand criteria for graduation for kids who have come into the country 7th grade or later. The reasoning behind that is that kids are given, and this is already codified, 7 years from coming into the country to be proficient in English. But if they come in 7th grade, that puts them past high school. So we already have codified and said these kids are not proficient when they graduate, right? So let's hold them to making the ELPT growth instead of the LEAP growth. So these kids would still sit for LEAP exams. They would still be required to pass all their courses. They would still be required to meet seat time requirements. But if they don't meet that approaching basic on the LEAP, they have to meet the prescribed trajectory on English language acquisition on the ELPT, and they have to complete a standards aligned portfolio for the LEAP 2025 courses. So this allows students to both show content mastery, right, in a cumulative way that's appropriate to their language acquisition level, and show that they are workforce and community ready, right, which is what a high school diploma means, by being on trajectory to acquire the English language.
And when we brought this to Superintendent Brumley in March, he challenged, he said, you know, this is interesting, this is a good pathway, but you need a coalition of supporters. It can't just be some educators. And so we've been working, you know, our butts off this past year, making sure that we have supporters in all areas, all organizations, all schools, and, you know, have a coalition of upwards more than 100 signers of organizations representing their organizations. But I think our biggest win thus far has been NOLA PS passing a resolution of support for the policy. Yeah, as well as challenging LDOE Superintendent Brumley and other parishes to write resolutions of support and to pass the policy. So we're touring around to different school boards. We're getting resolutions of support and hope to bring this back in front of the Board of Education within the next year.
Thank you all so much for, you know, for all of the knowledge and wisdom that you're sharing here. Let's say if somebody wants to get in touch with you, wants to learn more about the policy work that you're doing or just the practical work that you're doing, is there somewhere they can go, a page they can follow or an Instagram, like something they can do to maybe try to get a hold of one of you or both of you or a consulted NOLA in general?
So we have an Instagram account and then a Facebook page that's Excel Grad Pathway, but you can always email me at emeril@collegiateacademies.org.
And then I'm cchavez@opsb.us. And again, like keeping our efforts in perspective, right? Yes, the policy work is important, but like the day-to-day, like what are children in front of, right? The experiences that they have in the classroom is what we need to invest in. So the training for general education teachers that we do, right? The coaching model that we also provide schools and networks is valuable for here now in the moment as we're waiting on policy to pass.
Yeah, I think this is all fantastic. And so thank you all so much for being here with us today. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for your time. I'm very much looking forward to putting this episode, piecing it all together, sharing it with folks, and, you know, just continue to support your work and continue to support the students that we work with. So thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.